Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. My name is Carrie Sawyer, and I am your host for this episode. I am so excited to introduce you to a special guest who will be joining me today to talk all about activism, anti-racism, and our journeys. Her name is Veronica Dominguez. And one of the reasons why I'm really excited to talk to her is because she actually just presented a really, really interesting presentation at a conference. And her presentation is called Cultural Linguistic Diversity, which includes whiteness, microaggressions, and a guide to coded language. A little bit into the conversation, her co-presenter, Vanita Ra, will be joining us as well. And we're going to get to talk all about their presentation and what the experience was like for them. So let me introduce to you Veronica Dominguez. She is a lifelong student and advocate of women's and civil rights. Veronica is committed to understanding and verbalizing the interconnected issues of power, racism, sexism, capitalism, and other injustices. She works in the public schools with degrees in criminal justice and speech language pathology. Please join me in welcoming Veronica Dominguez to the Inclusion First Podcast. Veronica, I'm so excited that we were having this conversation. It's amazing. Let's talk a little bit about, I want to talk about activism in 2022.
It's friends talking. It's women who have shared history. It's brown women, Mexican women, black women. And those are concepts that, and names that have such a historical relevance that we, henceforth moving onward, are going to put the power back into that and not even reclaim a narrative, but update it and really imbue it with all of the gorgeousness and amazing scholarship that we have and all of the lived experiences from our ancestors. I mean, I think everyone on this planet is born with a gift, right? You have a gift, Carrie. I have a gift. Everybody has a gift. And that calling to do what's right, you don't have a choice. You wake up in the morning and it's like, no, this is happening. And you may even think, no, it's hard. I don't want to do it, or I'm the only one. But when it comes right down to it, the thought of saying absolutely nothing is just not an option for some of us.
No, you're so right. You're so right. That was so good.
And you got to be careful because I'm a talker. I've been a talker. I was born a talker and a reader. I read at a very early age and I read things that I didn't understand. But one thing I did understand is categorically, I loved people. I loved all people. And I was just fascinated by languages, people of color, the different ethnicities in my neighborhood. And then I also had the experience of crossing a color line to go to Catholic school. Hmm. And at that time, you know, there wasn't, when you cross color lines, you were either the only one or there was just no one, you know? And so I got to see really young power and humiliation. And I never understood what the big deal or why I never understood why whiteness was so legitimate and why I was not. And because I went to Catholic school, I took on white power and nuns at a very early age. And I experienced a lot of success moving that dial. And I think it was because I was so young that when truth needs to be told, it is unstoppable. And how it comes out of the mouth of a child, you almost like pepper spray or stun somebody. And they're just like, they're not going to argue with the child, especially who has just schooled them in humanity. So I just realized early on that the truth somehow made adults very uncomfortable. And I was like, well, I'll just roll with this.
Yeah, that is so interesting. It reminds me of a story that I'm actually putting in my book for my little brother. He's not little. He's like 39 or something, but he has a family. He has a daughter who's 7 and a son who, oh no, she's 8 now. They just turned 8 and 5. And Grace is my niece's name. And back when, you know, in the summer of 2020, she wanted to do a lemonade stand. And she was like, I'm going to do a lemonade stand so that I can give the money to Black Lives Matter, because they do. And Grace is actually mixed. Her mom is white and her dad is Black. And so seeing all of this play out, and he's like, we didn't tell her the news. We didn't show her the news, but it was such a heavy and pervasive thing that my seven-year-old niece like knew about it and knew that she wanted to do something about it. And it was super interesting. The story that my brother tells, he and his wife are like, they live in a predominantly white neighborhood in Michigan. And they're like, we're new to the neighborhood. Are we going to do this? Are we going to let Grace do this? Is this going to be safe? And what they came to was that, you know, really the point you just made, like truth needs to be told. And they're like, what kind of example are we going to set if we don't let her do this at this time? And so they did. And they have this super conservative neighbor, Trump flag flying person. That's not even allowed in the neighborhood. She does not care. She was the first person to come to the lemonade stand, of course. And they're just, my brother and Katie, my brother's wife, are just like, what is going, like, this is how we're starting the day. So Grace is super excited. She's sitting there at her lemonade stand, and the lady reads the sign and she says, Black Lives Matter. All lives matter, honey. And my niece just like looks at her, doesn't say anything. She just gives her like this look that's just like, I don't, what you said doesn't make sense. It's like, it said a million words, but it was just a look. And it throws this lady completely off. She puts down her $20 for the 50 cent lemonade and goes home. Like, that was it. That was the end of the confrontation. So what your story about truth and children and it making adults uncomfortable, my niece didn't say anything. She just looked at her, because what the hell are you talking about? Like, my brother was like, do we need to pop in here? Katie's like, do we need? And they didn't need to. Grace completely defused the situation, got that lady's money that did for sure go to Black Lives Matter.
And she got the Republican price too. I was about to tell you.
She sure did.
and you know what? What we know from the research is that we tend to think that people, let's say, now nobody's a monolith. So we all know everyone's different. If we are going to, just for the sake of making a category, we all know people that can somehow fall into that neighbor category or that Trump supporter category. And what the research tells us is very few people truly, truly are the racist kind of people that we believe them to be. Now, there are a few, right? There really are people who are committed to that. A larger percentage of people have such an unconscious bias. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But what the research shows us is, if you can't see it, it's not real. If it's not real, how are you going to talk about it? And how are you going to talk about something and get funding to study it if it doesn't exist? So what we have found, and children are very adept at this, when you take what is in your subconscious and you put it forward in the conscious and then it comes out as real, now you can see it. And when you can see it, now you can see the violations to all of humanity. And your niece's look brought this woman's unconscious racial bias class bias front and center. And that woman came to the reckoning herself, and she paid for it. She compensated for that remark. And that is moving the dial. But without an acknowledgement, or if your niece appeased her, eased her guilt, reassured her of her white legitimacy, consoled her for being the real victim, she probably would have asked for some change back, $19.50.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. Yes, it brought it front and center. This woman didn't accidentally walk by the lemonade stand. My sister-in-law had put it on the Facebook group. She legit came out at the time that it started and came over to troll a 7-year-old about how all lives matter. And then go the way that she expected. In a very peaceful, nonviolent way, right? Like, it was just a
bit. And you know, that exactly. And that's a great segue to peaceful and nonviolent, because that throws us back to the civil rights era about 50 years ago, when, or more than that now. Well, that was like,
what year are we
that
in?
Was when it changed. That was when they killed everybody, right? It was getting going, and then they killed everybody. And we cling to that because we haven't had a replacement model.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, in our minds, if we can begin to think of timelines, right? Because if we started talking about race and class today, it would look like this. If we went back to Reagan, it would look like this. If we go back to Bush, it's going to look like this. Nixon, it's going to look like this. Lyndon B. Johnson, it's going to look like this. Hoover, it's going to look like this. And then that's going to put us almost to like the early 1920s, let's say. And then let's take it back to slavery. And then let's take it back to pre-slavery. And when you can have that framework, and then not only you're gonna mark power, who had it, who didn't, who won, who didn't, and then you're gonna add the replacement systems, right? That once immigration, let's say, ended, and now Americans became the dominant citizen. That's the replacement. Once convict leasing replaced slavery, that is the replacement system. Okay, what replaces convict leasing? Okay, we think yes, mass incarceration. But then what replaces that? And so then mapped on top of that, now you're going to look. We need to look at power in terms of who was front and center with getting these ideas out, and what color were they? And that brings us to likely another talk around colorism, because within promoting a movement has to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that again is based in our history and our proximity to the colonizers. And then you look at Reconstruction, who was allowed in to present a message. Mm-hmm. And then on top of all of that, let's look at what built economic prosperity. And then on top of that is one of my favorite subjects, is art and music.
Mm.
Because with art and music, why is it that we can be so raw and so real, but only in art and music?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because art and music, I believe, now I haven't cross-referenced this. It's not even my idea. Well, it could be my idea. I've read so many things, so I don't know. You just, when you read so many things, yeah. And it's not, for me, it's not a point of this is mine. I thought of it. No, these are from all of these leaders before me that now and have always been in our DNA, if this is your calling. Mm. And it's everyone's calling, because the alternative then is this status quo. And if you choose this, you oppress everyone who is not white, male, and having access to elitism. So when you look at art and music, it has a deniability to it, right? Much like racism does. For example, if you look at people hardcore, what we would think of as racist, if you even bring up a color, then they turn it around and say, oh, you're the racist, you know, or they cloak racist terms in coded language so that they can deny it, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's all part of that strategy. But when you look at art and music, that's where people of color have been able to get it out, get the truth heard. But yet it's seen as art interpretation. It's not exactly historical fact. And we are here to set that record straight.
I think that it's so interesting that this part of what we're talking about started with this idea of, you know, peaceful and nonviolent. The contradictions, right? Because why did we as people of color have to be peaceful and nonviolent when racism is extremely violent and definitely not peaceful, extremely violent, traumatic, like ridiculously so. But in order for us to be heard, we had to be the opposite of that. And of course, all of the different stereotypes that go with what it means to be black or brown, stupid, violent, angry, hot-headed, all of these things, right? And that goes back to the narrative that you were talking about. Who was allowed in to the Reconstruction, who was allowed into the narrative that was being built, and then how that was proliferated, I can't say that word, but how it was pushed out throughout our society, and who wasn't allowed in for obvious reasons.
Thank you for tying all that together. I was going somewhere with that, and then...
That's what I'm here for.
But to add to that, what I find so fascinating, and, you know, when I talk about these things, and I it's not just the books or the articles or the comments, it's reading the bios of all of these people, and it gets to you because are the some of the most forward thinking intellectual, humanely empathetic, discerning people had to present this information. The only way they were able to get this out was to be nonviolent. You couldn't be angry. Within their private lives, the amount of depression, being suicidal, the attempts on their own lives, that self-inflicted anger, alcoholism, drugs, I mean, the whole interconnectivity of when you are forced to not speak a truth and show evidence, and you're forced to be in a animalistic, subhuman, debased, demoralized, dehumanized life, not only for the entirety of your life, but you come from people who that was their life. So you have generational wounds that never heal, and to have the knowledge in your mind and that with all certainty that this will be the outcome for your children. It is, and that's the part we don't speak of. And then often when we talk about our leaders, they tend to mostly be male. And that's another area that I'm really, really interested in, is how within, let's say, and we're only speaking of black and brown, we have an interconnectivity with Asians, Chinese Americans, especially in California, Filipino Americans, especially Japanese. And when you can separate the struggles out and make it seem, and then pit all of the oppressed against one another, now they've done distracted us, because they got us thinking that we're the enemy, we're the foreigner, we're the ones using all the resources, we're the young bucks buying T-bone steaks and driving Cadillacs, you know? And that's a reference I use often, because people don't understand where that coded language with using terms like that to describe people of color as wasting
the resources,
public resources, and not realizing that prior to the 1960s, and now we go into that whole, the era of the stock market crash, and then we needed to have the government come in and provide those fair deal programs for people. The majority of beneficiaries were white. And that is, and those government supports built the world's strongest, robust middle class. And they were not called welfare then. And on the heels of that, with the expansion, and people of color were excluded, outrightly so in some and not in others, from receiving those programs. And understanding those exclusions are really important in seeing how big business and government and the wage of whiteness continue to support resources and upward mobility specific for whites and rich whites. Mm-hmm. With the onset of the civil rights, and now we're like, hey, we want those programs to include us. We want to go to college. We want to get loans to get homes. We want good schools. We want, by the time they allowed that, the politics of the time then shifted that language. Instead of supportive programs to help hardworking, deserved Americans, now it became welfare.
Right.
And now it became Black people don't want to work, and Mexican people or brown people, they're lazy and rapists. And then you have Israeli or Middle Eastern people, who are terrorists. And many people don't know how that language shifted. And that is why the racism that we saw front and center in the 1960s has been replaced by such a coded system that we don't realize that it is just as insidious, just as powerful. And given that the politics around how everyone is supposed to access resources, education, housing, good schools, healthcare, how all government and big business are working together to maintain and dominate market. If you dominate the market, you dominate labor, you get to decide. It's already decided who's going to have the good jobs. If you have good jobs, you got money. If you got money, you can influence government. You can influence government and you can make change. And you look at how much education costs now, your biggest occupational hazard is a bachelor's degree.
Right? Yeah.
So anyways.
That's amazing. No, thank you for that synthesis and that you just kind of sharing and dropping some knowledge on us for sure. So like, how do you define activism in 2022? And do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Ooh, yes. I was born an activist because I was born in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. And so not only do I have Black Panther roots, but my family, that's my mom's side, and then my dad's family. So I got city folks and country folks. I guess I got to say it like that, you know? And having both of those accesses to one of the most political forward-moving places of the country. Because, you know, you had people coming in and out from Mexico to work. And then we've always lived here, right? And then you had mass exodus of people from the South. So basically you get the South and you get Mexico and then you get the Chinese who came over. Now let's go back way back to the gold rush, right? So you get all of these populations and the neighborhoods just budding and intermixing and many times. So my world from the jump, those were my people. I am the daughter of a daughter of a daughter of working class immigrant, hardworking, traveling people that can get stuff done. And, you know, imagine if we didn't call migrant workers or farm workers, for example, and this is across Black, brown, Asian, Imagine if they were called agriculturist, horticulturist, because that's what in essence they are.
Right? There's an expertise that is happening while all of the during this work, just the same way anyone who is doing work on a regular basis becomes an expert in it. And these names are designed on purpose, right? It's not an accident that they're labeled in this way.
So because I, from an early age, and from an early age, I was introduced to colorism also in my own, in my own life. I am the darkest person in my family. My dad's family, they're short and super white skin. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom's family is taller and browner. With my mom's family, you know, this is city folks, where in that time, the census labeled them as Spanish. They didn't get to Mexico until they decided, yeah, these Spanish people, it's better if we call them Mexicans because they're too much trouble for the government. And you know what? If we just leverage as much violence as we do against Black people, now we do it against brown people. Ooh, we got two underclasses and we have a steady stream of cheap labor and inmates that can pretty much fund and run and on its own replace any and all types of extinct quote unquote slavery system that we used to have, you know? Right. And if we get the public support for that, oh, this is, we can do this across the board to anyone. And that, and then we're going to distract people with money and we're going to scare everybody about everybody and really have them in God We Trust is going to be like a dollar bill. Well, not a dollar bill, but like a $100 bill, right? And so I knew this from like the age I was five. And so from that, I always developed my language. And I, because my family in Fresno, Clovis area, they grew up in severe racist times. So my aunts, there are none of them are past like 4'11". But I'm telling you, you don't want to mess with them. And so I grew up with that kind of, we ain't taking this. This is how hard we, and my dad's family were connected to the community. So they were actually, they knew the community. They provided food for the community. They worked with a variety of Californian born and migrant workers. And they were able to communicate, you know, both with an American dialected, Spanish, Mexican, English vernacular. And then also, this was like the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They got to live through that music, those times, and it really was power to the people. My mom's family, when now you go to more sophisticated land area, it's about assimilation. Mm-hmm. And so my mom's family grew up, there was 10 of them. You know, my mom's family and then five of them in my dad's family. So I think the question was, do I see myself as an activist? And 100%. And I guess that personal connection for me is back to the colorism, being the darkest person on my dad's family. I don't, if you ever get a bag of beans, ask Roman, okay? Get a bag of beans and there'll always be like one black one in there, right? In that bag of pinto beans, that's me.
Oh my gosh.
And so, but on my mom's family, they had brown like me too, but on my mom's family, they married whites mostly, except for two. And I was so glad. I could see the difference because we lived in poverty. I grew up, my mom didn't grow up in poverty, but we did, you know? And so, seeing that difference of that strong activist working class background on my dad's family, and then seeing my mom also come from that same background, but then assimilate and try to kind of hide and pass. And then for me, my sister is whiter than that door you have behind you. She's super white and her eyes are green. And my mom and dad later divorced. And then my my brother came along and he's super white with green eyes too. And so as a kid going shopping anywhere, just the amount of times we were stopped and people would look at my sister and they'd be like, oh my gosh, she's so gorgeous. We look almost exactly alike, which was weird to me. And then they'd look at me and they'd be like, oh, who's this?
Who are you? What are you doing here? You're like, what?
And I just was like, I refused to let myself be discarded or the uglier daughter simply because I was brown. And so I made myself fine. I didn't have to make myself hard. I was just like, yeah.
It's not going to work for me.
And I love this way
you're identifying me is not going to work.
And I was fat. I loved people who looked like me, people who were black, people who were Asian, people who, it didn't matter what they were. I was thinking about this last night. I don't have this concept of foreigners. Like, you don't belong here. I never understand. It doesn't occur to me to even think that way because the world belongs to all of us. We should have passports everywhere. Why do you get to decide whether I'm treated well based on you giving me some type of passport that says I'm legitimate? No, this world doesn't belong. This place doesn't belong to any of us that way. So I don't know. I was like this also with gay, lesbian, trans. And even as a young child, you know, your parents, your people, your own family members will make jokes or whatever. And I would be sitting there fuming as an 8-year-old at this point. And I would say, you know what, to my mom or my sister, to anybody until to this day, I'll be like, you know, if you think that's so funny, would you say that if that person was sitting here? And then I'll just take it for, how do you think they would feel that you're laughing at them and you're ridiculing them? Maybe you, and I would tell my mother, maybe you don't know what color we are, mom. You're like, apparently you don't know. And the problem that I have with that is that if I make it, you make it, Vinita makes it. Okay. But you know what? As a group, we are still in the black, brown, animal, terrorist, threatening, criminal. We are, all of us are there. So yes, I have been an activist and I have never, never stayed silent watching somebody be humiliated in front of me because that's like I am contributing to my own oppression, my own criminalization. And how dare you, especially when I know yours is illegitimate.
Sure.
Yeah, so let's welcome Vinita. Oh my God, I'm so glad she came.
Lovely. Awesome. Welcome. How are you? I'm so excited to hear about the work that you two are doing together. So it's the perfect time to segue and talk a little bit about that. And I have, you know, I have all these podcast questions. And really, the question that I wanted to phrase to both of you was like, tell me a little bit about the change that you're creating in the world. And I think, I mean, I've heard a little bit about it. And I just wanted to get Vinita and Veronica on to talk about this incredible presentation, the conference, how it went, what it was like for you. I need to know everything. So let's do this.
Go Vinita. No, let's get a little bio on Vinita.
Yes, please, Vinita. Start off by letting us know who you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. My name is Vinita. My pronouns are she, her. I am first generation immigrant from India. And I became a legal citizen, I guess, about 5 years ago. Until then, I was a legal alien in the United States. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and it's been an incredible journey working and learning and growing in this area. So in speaking about the conference, we saw this thing come up, the Human Rights and Equity Conference come up in LA, and I saw it, and just knowing Veronica and knowing all the work she's been doing, I said, hey, you should apply. You need to be a speaker there. And so Veronica was like, okay, but if I do this, I'm doing it my way. And I said, yeah, you have to do it your way or no way, that's fine. And so she worked on it the day it was due, turned in the application, and then we never heard anything until 4 weeks before the conference, they said we were in. And then it was like this frenzy of getting everything organized and together. And it took a lot of work. We started with, I think, 80 slides, and then working through them and trying to figure out what we wanted to say, how we wanted to say it. And I think we both felt this sense of urgency, like, okay, this is our one chance to share all this information with everybody. And okay, so which things do we want to share? Which can we leave out and which can we not leave out? And so in the end, we got it down to 30 slides, but even that was so hard to do.
Tell me the name of the talk that you gave.
I have it right here for us. Cultural Linguistic Diversity, which includes whiteness, by the way, Challenging Microaggressions and Guide to Coded Language.
All right, so what's the summary of that talk? We're going to get into the details, but like, what was the talk about at a high level?
I think Vinita's so good with summarizing, because one thing I do want to add to this story is that I said, and back to the advocate activist, what kind of activist? I am an activist for women of color. White people and elite white people, middle, upper class white people struggling to recognize color and privilege and their legitimacy. They have a lot of people working with them. Our people do not. And what you go through as a professional of color is daily a struggle. You have limited mentors in college. When you get into your profession, people will select you. And when I say people, white women in power, because they are 90 to 100% leadership. They will select you based on if you meet their expectations of not violating social norms, which means protecting whiteness and white power. And poor white
sector that we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And poor whites fall in our category too. So poor whites are a different kind of whiteness than middle upper class elites. And that deserves mention. And we are at heart humanitarians. And so we make no silent covenants to conceal this. And so when we wrote this, when Benita told me to do it, you have to understand, we push each other so hard a lot of the time because it's scary. And there are repercussions, you know, to your advancement, how you're seen, whatever status you may have acquired up until this point, you know? So Vinita said, they probably won't select us. And so I wrote it with that in mind. To our surprise, they did select us. And that really, you know, that's a higher power way of us being told that this is important.
So when you said that you wanted to do it your way, Veronica, what does it mean to do it your way versus not your way?
Through the lens of race, class, and color versus colorblind. We are not all the same. We don't have the same opportunities. We're not treated the same by law enforcement, by the law, by education, by healthcare standards, private insurance, middle upper class whites mainly, and some of us who now can afford healthcare. Left side, Medi-Cal, predominantly black and brown. And we have now research and from people, women like us who are doctors, who are writing about this now, but it's so few and far in between. And there are many people who give up what they love to do what's right. And at some point, I don't doubt that many of us will be like, wow, I got into this field And now I see what this field is about. And power's concentrated at the center. This is what I've been, you know, we always show that power wheel. Every time you go to any type of conference, there's a power wheel, right? And you can see all of that power's on the center. What I see is all of the space around that center. That's wide open. That is wide open for us. Because you try to talk about stuff in the center, the closer you get into the center, the wider it gets. And when I say wider, wider, more powerful. And that means your voice now becomes diluted, 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 until you're not able to say anything real. But out here, they don't want to talk about that. When I say they, I'm talking about the power elites. That means their silence is our, we don't need permission, but the fact that they won't engage with us, we get to write the narrative. And since they don't want to talk about this, perfect. We'll do it. Because that's healing and empowering. There's going to be some girl out there who hears us talk, and it's not going to take her till she's 40 years old, to 50 years old, 60 years old. We've got to take on that baton, I don't want to say baton, that next step, that bell hooks, Angela Davis, Dolores Huerta, you know, many other women, Anna Mae Wong, you know, we have to take it forward with more direct language that they provided us all the scholarly stuff. I'm not writing another book because I'm telling you, there's so many books out there. I want to we need to synthesize it because the younger generation, you know, we're the youngest, oldest generation. And we grew up, I believe, in more of an environment of sisterhood. These girls now are born in such a capitalistic, competitive environment. They're out there alone and they're competing against one another. And it's really, they need us to now become the continuation of those voices, Anita Hill, Ana Castillo, you know, Lorraine Hansberry, you know, and there's just so many more. Toni Morrison is brilliant. We work as speech and language pathologists, but inside of us is language. And you're going to tell me I can't find language to map this forward? Yeah, you ain't telling me that or Benita that. But Benita can do Benita can do the summary because, oh no, I'm not good at summaries.
Yeah, tell us about, like, you know, what are the top points that you covered in your talk? Remind me of the title again because I want to write it down.
So our talk was cultural and linguistic diversity, which includes whiteness, by the way, challenging microaggressions, and a guide to coded language. So really what we wanted to talk about was coded language and being able to identify and challenge microaggressions. Because like Veronica said, we're speech language pathologists, and in thinking about social justice and thinking about anti-racism and thinking about anti-bias, figuring out how we could be part of the movement, right? Mm. And so our role in that is to see how language is used to be racist, to be biased, to have power, and try and show people how to push back against these things. And so our talk started with a history. Well, we want to see where do these privileges stem from and where do they come from? How do most white people view cultural diversity versus most people who are BIPOC view this diversity? When you look at some of the research, the videos out there, you can see a difference. So we wanted to start there, dig a little deep into the history, because we have to know the foundation before we can build on it, right? So we started with the history, talking about some of the things that paved the way for these privileges, and then discussed coded language and microaggressions and pushing back against those things.
What was the number one takeaway that you had for the audience?
It's hard. It's hard, but there's hope. I know we often hear that it takes a village, but in these times, find your partner, find that person who will say, let's do this together. And with that one person, you can push forward and you can make a difference.
I love that. We talk a lot at the Inclusion First Institute about finding the people that are raising their hand to do it too. It's not about convincing people. Yes, there's a space for that, but I don't have time to convince you, because while I'm trying to convince you, I'm not moving forward with the people who are ready to move forward now. And I'm much more concerned about moving forward now than dragging you when you're not ready to go there, right? And so I love this idea of finding your partner, finding your people who are like, yeah, I want to play in that sandbox with you. I'm all bought in. I have these ideas. I can build on what you're saying. Let's go.
It's not easy. You love your friends and you love your family. And it's hard to be critical of what you revere. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, though, then we can't help heal and have authentic conversations. So, and we have challenging talks a lot now because, I understand the backlash, and you've got to be able to get through that. It sucks. We are all much more harmonious people. And so to be seen and criticized for what is right is something that you make your amends with daily. And so one thing Vinita told me more recently is, she said, I want you to push me. I want you to keep me honest. And I want her to do the same with me, you know? And it's great when, and this is usually how it happens. One person's feeling like, okay, we could do this. The other person's like, I can't do this. And then it seems to switch. We have yet to find ourselves both at the bottom going, no, I can't do that.
Okay. You're like, no, I got you. I got you today. We can do this. Uh-huh. Absolutely. No, I love that. So I haven't seen the talk. As you all are talking here, I'm like, I know that it wasn't recorded, but I'm like, where can we have you redo the talk for an audience? I'm thinking about that right now, but I want to know, like, what was it like for you to present this information that you really felt like was, for lack of a better word, like provocative, that was like raw, that was truthful, that was super direct? What was that experience like? And who was the audience? Like, this is not a Black and brown audience from my understanding. So tell me a little bit about that experience.
Actually, it was. It was mostly, was it? We had like maybe one row of mostly whiter women who were older. Mm-hmm. And then there were some younger women sparse through in the Black and brown section, you know. But I think I mentioned this to you in one of our email attacks. Our videos failed. Our beautiful videos that we had failed. So, you know, it was almost as if we actually were mic and podium. And then the slides that we're showing were working for a minute, and then they stopped working. And I didn't realize this. And so Vinita realized this up there. And we were supposed to have 15 minutes to set up. We had 7. And so our room packed so quick. And I don't tell time, but I know what it feels like. And so I was like, and Vinita's telling me to come on, come on. And I'm like, wait, we have like 8 more minutes left. No, room filled up. And we had tested our equipment. So it's basically, we're outside of the conference room, literally outside. Everything was working. You walk through the door, everything should continue to work. No, it didn't. And so as we began this and we're talking about it, and we didn't use coded language. And when I'm calm, then I guess I think my speech and my voice sounds a particular way. But when I get mad and when I tap into... And I'm not able, when I tap into the foundation of why I'm upset. It's like my brain hyper focused, and it's a particular tempo and maybe a dialect. And I would have to say like a dialect, because I don't need to sound academic. I don't need to sound like an elite upper whiter class person that has been educated in an Ivy League institution. I can have sophisticated information that's accessible to people like me. This is for people like me and Benita. And if we make it so complicated, people like us are gonna tune out. So once we got in there, it was like we were talking to our friends and family, and we kept it like that the whole way through. And we even told them, well, I didn't tell Benita this part, but in my mind I was like, I anticipated opposition, a lot more of it, right? So we put a sign-in sheet, and I said, you know, put your name, and I think I told you this too, put your name on the sign-up sheet, tell us what you like and what you didn't. And I said it just like that, and I inflected it. I inflect to show meaning, because if I don't inflect, I'm not going to cut through and get into the heart of the matter. And you're not, this is going to be too sanitized, too clean, and you're not going to attend to this. So it was a whole talk just like this, and we didn't realize how intense it must have been until at one point in the conference, we needed to kind of take a break only because of, I could see something was happening with the slides. And so we had brought taffy and whistles, because coded language becomes dog whistle language in politics. And then if you look at taffy, this is how dominance and whiteness and elitism can be stretched to include groups that were not previously included before, you know? Like, so when you look at the history of how did Polish, Irish, Italians, how did they get assimilated into standard white? And that was all political, because they needed more votes. And they included what was historically considered what the Protestant higher class Anglo-Saxon legitimate whites, they included a lesser breed of white to get that political vote. And so we brought that to show that if we are not highly critical of votership, we are going to miss how government is going to stretch again and include people who are not formally white to be white, to continue that really strong Republican Party politics that at the core right now, one of the most single divide is race and class within the Republican Party. It didn't used to be like that prior to the 60s. And so then you got to ask why. And it is to keep that class and caste and race system firmly intact. So at this point where the slides no longer worked, and we had it, I felt it was probably like a roller coaster unbeknownst to us, because we got in there and was just go. We got 90 minutes, and admittedly we had all this information because we presented like it was going to be our last. Imagine your last 90 minutes. What are you going to say, right? So we went in there, and I think we're like, and then we hit a crescendo. And then on the way down, that's when we said, let's take this break. And when we handed out this candy, oh my God, the whole room, you just felt the whole room go, And so I realized, to do it again, to build in some more reflection time.
I think we started the presentation talking about how, as much as it was a presentation and we were sharing information, it was also a conversation and a discussion. And we did want to hear their experiences, their thoughts, their questions, and to make all of that a part of our learning together. Mm-hmm. And like Veronica said, there were people who were white, there were people who were brown, there were people who were Asian. And I think we all have these conversations in our groups, in our little, villages. But this place and time, we were all in it together. And we were having these open discussions together. And I think that was something that was different. And so when it did get to that point, it was because people were asking these questions. And then as we were providing information, other people were backing that up with their experiences, with their actual real life thoughts and things that had happened to them or things that they saw that were on those slides, right? And I think that was
of one of the experiences that was shared in the room as you were talking and sharing everything.
Yeah, so one of the things we talked about were leadership positions and leadership roles, and we were reflecting about the demographics in schools, how the majority of students in schools right now are not white, but leadership and these positions of authority are mostly white. And how do you think that makes our children feel, right? And one of the people in the audience shared that he was doing a PhD program, and for the longest time, he had never seen somebody who looked like him in a position of leadership like that. There was just maybe one professor. And when he found that professor, he said he really felt that difference, like, oh, I can do this too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this idea of we can only find comfort when there are people who look like us and why that is. And of course, there's all the natural things that our brain does. But I think the biggest thing is like, when you see someone that looks like you, there's an assumption of like validation and that you're going to be heard and that they're not going to think you're lying or crazy or trying to get around the system or doing something you're not supposed to be doing just by looking at you. And when you see someone who doesn't look like you, we actually have no idea, especially in positions of like where the power differential, like a classroom, are so great. You have no idea how that person is going to like take you, understand you, have empathy for you. And so it's not possible for us to, in every situation that we're in, have someone who's going to look exactly like us. But what if we were able to actually teach people who don't look like us to stop invalidating, to stop doubting, to stop mistrusting, so that, yeah, you're not going to have the same feeling as if you see a brown person. Sure. But it's not going to be as terrible as, oh God, what am I going to get here? This person might hate me. They're going to think I'm lying. I really did lose my homework. I did it. I swear. But now you're going to be like, well, you know, I'm going to take you at your word. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to take your story and experience as true versus deciding that I'm a judge or God, and I can validate or invalidate based on my own experiences, which can be very different than yours. And this idea that if I haven't experienced it or heard of it, it can't be true, or it's not real, or it needs to be examined more, is bullshit, honestly. Like, your understanding or experience of something has nothing to do with truth or what happened with someone else. They're not related. I was thinking about this. I was taking a nap before so I could be fresh. And I was just like, this analogy of like, if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound? Like, who cares if it makes a sound or not? The tree fell in the woods, whether or not you were there, you heard it, you witnessed it. Your perception of the sound of the tree falling has nothing to do with the concrete fact that the tree fell. And so if we were to take each other's experiences and truths like that, I don't have to have any idea. All I need to know is that you're a human being who's worthy of being validated and trusted, because the majority of us are. There's these extreme cases that we use to apply to everyone, like, oh, that guy lied, so you must be a liar too. Like, no, most people are not lying, not cheating, not trying to get over on anyone. They're just trying to live their lives, provide for their family, thrive, be happy. If that is our assumption when I see you, regardless of whether you are black, brown, white, green, or purple, as my mother would say, like, I'm going to give you that same trust and that same validation of who you are no matter what.
And I think that gets to that central question is trust. You know, do we trust ourselves? Because it's a collective shared suffering. And by not talking about whiteness, then we don't talk about how whites are impacted and stunted and struggling themselves with unresolved issues of grief, imposter syndrome, you know, undeserved opportunities. And we have research that shows, like, you know, when you teach kids and children about race, then the impact and the stereotypes and the harmful effects decrease. And from this research, 70% of white parents understand, have an idea of this, yet do not talk to their children about race. So the focus needs to be on, let's say, whiteness, and whiteness coming to an understanding, a deep understanding of themselves. And I think white, you know, having allies to talk to white people about this, white people. So when we make that connection, us talking to each other, there is that shared understanding that we all come from impacted and historically disenfranchised people. Even if you happen to be rich, Carrie, like your family is generationally wealth people, you're still black compared in the United States. And we know what that means. I'm still brown. She's still brown too, you know? And so I don't understand why we have turned our back. To make it means you're going to pass into the middle class, kind of like passing for white, right? Mm-hmm. Why have we turned our back on the working class? Why don't we, what I notice is when you get into the middle class, don't nobody talk about being poor. And so part of our presentation was to bring this realness back. Either you got resources or you got roaches. That's what this is about.
It's so cut and dry, so simple.
You can't have both. You know what I mean? And so it's funny, to make it then means you no longer talk about where you're from. And I will always rep working class. It's working class that is, now we're going to even have underclasses because we don't have access and control over labor. Why would I want to belong to a class of people that ignores and forgets other human beings? And to do that then means I'm doing that to solidify my position. Mm-hmm. The only reason I'm not talking about underclasses, working class, is so that I'm my sense of who I am is not threatened. My position.
And you're not associated with, your proximity from them is far.
Yeah, I'm not like those people.
They're mixed up. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I'm all about those are all our people. Those are my people. You know what? This talking to you, that's what those people look like. Empowered. This is empowerment right here. And it's not supposed to be for all.
And I think Veronica and I have had some discussions too about the Freedom Riders, you know, on that bus, there were white people too. There were white people who didn't need to be on that bus. And they too sacrificed their lives for this cause that they saw was bigger than themselves. So often it takes people of power, people from franchised groups, stepping into the disenfranchised groups to make that difference.
Mm-hmm. And not because they have an interest convergence. And that's a shout out to Derek Bell, right? That basically he came up with that idea, if we don't know already, that white people will get involved only when it serves their self-interest. And we can see so much of that with a lot of the programs and diversity movements, right? But there's so, this is how we cross that race and class, that this affects all of us. That's why I would like to move the focus off of us, let's say, as this vulnerable group, the most needy group. Let's talk about the most empowered group. What's that like? Tell us about what it's like to live in that world where you just wake up every day and you're just this individual that goes out in the world without having to code switch, without having to think about the police, without having to think of, you know, if I have a child, is this child going to be dark? You know, what's that like? When we ask our colleagues who are master, triple degreed people who teach at universities, they will not engage in a conversation. And that silence is because we can understand what that's from. And so we do need to bring the classes and the races together through an open dialogue. And this will happen. But I do think white people need to see a version of themselves that is that is bringing them together around their issues. You know how it's always our issues? Mm-mm. This ain't an our issue thing. This is an issue that we need to talk about. Come to the table and let's clear some of this up. Mm-hmm. Let's have a shared understanding moving forward about what we're going to call this. Yeah. And I think, to me, that is, many people of color will lose their patience if they have to convince white people to at least consider historical, social, political, educational, healthcare evidence. It's not made up. We're not making this up. Why would we sit here and make up some crazy stuff? I have other crazy stuff that I would love to invent that's more fun than, you know, making up lies, you know? Yeah. So.
And I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, why? I just don't understand why. I mean, I guess it threatens identity and who you are and all these things. And so you just want to reject it. But this idea that they made it up, or the idea of, I was thinking also about after my nap, like playing the race card. Like, what benefit is there to play the race card? There is nothing. If I'm playing the race card, it's because, playing in quotes, the race card, I just had a traumatic racial experience. There's no benefit to that. It's not like, oh, playing the pregnant card where I get to sit down. Yay, something good happened. Nothing good happens from playing the race card. So why would we play the race card?
The answer to that is pretty scary, I feel. Because what's happening, and this is codified, and you look to the Supreme Court, what's happening is they're setting the stage to have whites be the victims of racial crime. And that is already happening.
Well, yeah. I mean,
and so where you'll have white people, for example, in lawsuits under unfair labor practices, instead of repping the unfair labor practices, which will change the work environment for all of the employees, they're asserting and winning cases of racial bias towards them. Once we start getting case law established that whites are now the victims, basically, we're going back to the 1920s. Actually, we probably didn't ever leave the 1920s, because very few whites, as you see, whites in power, are ever prosecuted. But now they're going to legitimize that, and we will have no way to contest that legalized power. And that is what we need to start thinking about. We don't have civic agency. You ask people, okay, our age and upward, you know, luckily we're born with still an understanding of a recent past through our parents, right? But the newer generation, if their parents are our age, right, they're born into capitalism versus racism. Mm-hmm. Capitalism first, then racism, right? Or it's not that bad. And you see how the music has changed. When you look at political hip hop, let's say, you know, there was a call for action in the music. But that shifted, you know, to now it's a call to action about myself, about me making a grip, right? And you see people commoditizing themselves simply to make money and get ahead. Where's our political messaging? You know, and when you ask people, let's say 30 years below, you know, you ask them if they see racism, they believe in racism, it's happening. But as far as the power to influence government, they don't believe in it. So this next movement needs to come from the ground, and it will come from Black and brown and immigrant people. And what we're already seeing is what we haven't historically seen, which is really exciting. is you're seeing alliances between Black and Asian as far as reparation, as far as supporting Black Lives Matter, because it's almost, if you think about it, it's almost the opposite, the same, two different sides of the same coin. Both the two most powerful groups, let's say, in terms of power and money, right? Black power, for all of the historical reasons and the visibility. Asian power in terms of meeting whites pound for pound for income and education, but zero access to CEO leadership positions. And they're going to start, they've already begun and already have this as a back burner plan. We're going to demonize China and India and Japan. You better watch yourself, right? And so these two groups now have the same, have a similar issue, but for different reasons. And you're seeing that come together. And when we can, now we need to get the Latino vote. We need to get the Latinos to understand
that they're being used and manipulated for the vote.
Where you can be white by law. But what's been so cool now is when you look at all of these movements. And so we think we don't have the power to influence, but we do, because this is the first time in recent history, when you look at the results for the census, that across the board, nobody's claiming white. So this white elite, powerful, racist underpinning stuff, everyone's like, yeah, you can keep all that. I'm going to mark other. Other is like the 50% category now, because, and that was really scary before I knew the results of this census, because you go back to the census, I think probably back before the 1970s, Puerto Rico had claimed more whiteness than United States did. I find that so funny. Now Puerto Rico has this huge movement to acknowledge Afro roots. Mm-hmm. Mexico has a huge population of Afro-Mexicanos. They were, and this is much like Colombia, right? Where you have the Palenques and you have the communities of descended African people. Mexico did not recognize the Afro-Latino community as a legitimate people till 2015.
Wow.
And that's my problem with, you know, the salsa scene in San Diego, is that it's dominated not by Afro. And that is the root of salsa. But you know what? If you got, imagine the salsa instructors in San Diego trying to teach a very rhythmic dance. Yeah, they're not white people are not going to go for that. They need it broken down and really taught in a very commoditized way. And even, you know, because I have taken some of these classes, and I will, you know, some of the instructors will introduce what music they're playing. They very rarely attribute its roots to Afro. It's always about ballroom dancing. And I'm sorry, when you go dance in the street, don't nobody dance like that. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. If you go try to dance like that at any of these islands, they're going to look at you like, nobody dances like that. Yeah. Why are you doing that? You know, but I find it very interesting that, again, teaching, even within the salsa scene, is dominated not by people of color, not by dark people. And I want to see some dark people up in the joint.
Plus one. Ladies, this has been amazing. I want to know, where can we find more of you? If people want to follow your work, if they're curious about your presentation and they want to talk to you, they want to actually get out there and create a space for you to do this presentation again, because I can tell how dynamic it was, how intense and important it was, and it needs to be done again. So where can people find you if they want to learn more about your work?
Just tell us where you want us to come present it again and we'll do it. And please know that, you know, we get fired up. We love people. We want, I have, you know, it's not a question of we don't like white people. Let's get that clear. Vinita has an interesting story with her own family members and Europeans. So do I. It's crossing that and saying the what we got going on now is not good for anyone. Anyone. And if we continue this, California will be another Texas and it will be another Florida. And you got to think about that in terms of land. Who owns the land? Money, power, and land, right? And who's buying up? Look, it's almost $700,000 for a condo in San Diego. No, that's crazy. But if you can get enough powerful investors, who's owning San Diego? Not the people. And if this happens to California, trust me, women's rights will be rolled back to. Clarence Thomas don't look like he's dying anytime soon. So, you know, we can talk about him on another day. But this is for all of us and for our children moving forward. And we cannot lose sight of humanity. And that for the dollar. And that is what really we have done. So anytime you want us to come talk, we'll do it again. This is very new to us. We put it together. We will be honored to do it again. I don't know if it will be like our first one, because our first one, you're just so raw and you don't know.
Yeah, you'll probably.
But doing it again, we're like, okay, all right. Well, I think we're good now. The cops aren't outside waiting for us. You know, I don't want to get arrested 22 times like Dolores Huerta. I don't want to get beat up when I'm almost 60. But that's what these people did then. You know.
Yeah, they had to get their word out, and the risk was different. It was different. Ladies, thank you so much for sharing about your presentation, about your stories, your thoughts, your insights. This has been a super powerful episode of the Inclusion First podcast, and we're excited to see where this goes, to create spaces to get this word out and to have you back as this message gets around.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast. We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.